Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. I want to begin today's show by acknowledging the fact that we are about to surpass 500,000 COVID deaths in the United States. Yesterday, I lost a cousin to COVID. We spent holidays together as kids, but grew apart as adults. It is still such a tragic loss. On tomorrow's show, we will spend the hour remembering those we've lost. And we decided to continue with today's show as scheduled because in some ways it is COVID related. We're talking today with New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert about her new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. And in the book, she details how humans have intervened in natural systems and have profoundly changed the planet. Well, last March, this is March of 2020, Inger Andersen, executive director of the UN Environment Program, said nature is really sending us a message with the COVID pandemic. She said, quote, "Our continued erosion of wild spaces has brought us uncomfortably close to animals and plants that harbor diseases that can jump to humans. There are too many pressures at the same time on our natural systems, and something has to give." She says we are intimately interconnected with nature, whether we like it or not. If we don't take care of nature, we cannot take care of ourselves. And as we hurtle towards a population of 10 billion people on this planet, we need to go into this future armed with nature as our strongest ally. And Elizabeth Colbert writes about this in her new book, Under a White Sky. She writes that people have directly transformed more than half the ice-free land on Earth and indirectly half of what remains. We've dammed or diverted most of the world's major rivers. Our planes, cars, and power stations emit about 100 times more carbon dioxide than volcanoes do. In the age of man, there's nowhere to go, and this includes the deepest trenches of the oceans and the middle of the Antarctic ice sheet. Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Sixth Extinction, which won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction in 2015. She's a two-time National Magazine Award winner and a visiting fellow at Williams College's Center for Environmental Studies. I hope you can check out her book. It's called Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me. And I just want to start by saying I'm really sorry to hear about your cousin. That's very, very painful.
Well, you know, thank you so much. And it's hard to have someone else host the show under COVID because we're all hosting from home. And, I thought long and hard about it. We already rescheduled you and I didn't want to do that again. And the fact is, the nature aspect and how it's connected to COVID is just not getting that much attention. And we're all affected by this now, a year later. We either know someone who passed, we know someone who's had it. You know, 6 months ago, it really wasn't in a lot of our bubbles, and now it is. And I just think it's important to be real about all of this. So, you know, I'd love for you to start off by talking about, you know, what Inger Andersen said, that our continued erosion of wild spaces is bringing us uncomfortably close to animals and plants that harbor diseases that can jump to humans.
Well, I think that's, you know, indisputably true. And I think, you know, the other aspect of it is the way we treat our domesticated animals, which, you know, honestly, maybe we don't know. We really don't know where COVID originated. We don't know what the original animal host is. It's assumed that it was probably bats, but whether it jumped directly to humans from bats, from some contact of people, you know, coming into contact with bats that they hadn't previously come into contact with, or whether it came through an intermediary species. But, you know, one of the reasons that wet market in Wuhan attracted so much attention originally, although that does not seem to be, you know, the place where the virus jumped species, that hypothesis seems to have sort of fallen by the wayside, is because when you bring animals in from the wild, which, you know, we're increasingly, well, I mean, we've always obviously caught wild animals. I shouldn't say that. But we are bringing them now into urban centers. And you could see that as a potential recipe for disaster. But also the way that we crowd our domesticated animals into very small spaces. We live right on top of them. They live right on top of us. Another recipe for diseases jumping species.
Exactly. And this just deserves more attention. Over the weekend, Russian authorities said that they detected what is believed to be human infection with avian influenza H5N8. And I'm just reading from CNN right now. Russia notified the WHO of the possible strain and said, if confirmed, this would be the first time that H5N8 has infected people. And this is the first case of avian flu strain in humans in Russia.
Yeah, no, all of this is, if you think about, you know, how we live now in 2021 as a vast experiment, and, you know, as you pointed out, we're heading towards 10 billion people right now. We're on the cusp of 8 billion people. It's a vast experiment of how to live on planet Earth. And the fact that it has a lot of unintended consequences, you know, really shouldn't surprise anyone. How's that?
Right. Well, and talk about what got you interested in the topic of your latest book, because we had you on when you wrote The Sixth Extinction. You got so much acclaim for that important book. And this one is so interesting because you talk about how humans really changed nature. And now we're at a point, and we'll talk about the specifics. Now we're at a point where we need to change it again because of the first decision that was made. So what got you interested in this topic?
Well, the very first reporting trip that I took that became part of the book, it's actually at the center of the book, was to Hawaii a few years ago, maybe 4 years ago, to visit a project that had already been nicknamed, you know, not by me, the Super Coral Project. And the idea behind that project was, well, we've altered the oceans really dramatically. That's a function of having poured a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. That's warming, you know, the air, the land, and the oceans very rapidly. And it's also somewhat less known, but perhaps equally significant, changing the chemistry of the oceans, because a lot of that CO2 is being absorbed by the oceans, and it has the effect of lowering the pH, of making the oceans more acidified. And one group of organisms that really does not like either of these impacts is reef-building corals, which are these really tiny gelatinous animals that build these amazing, you know, very tough structures that we know as coral reefs, which are crucial to marine ecology. And they've been really devastated in recent years by these events that have been, I'm sure your listeners have heard about, these coral bleaching events. So the idea behind this Super Coral Project was, well, we've already, you know, messed around with the oceans. If we want to have reefs in the future, we're going to now have to sort of mess around with reef building corals. We're going to have to figure out a way to get corals that are hardy enough to survive in this sort of brave new ocean that we're creating. And when I thought about that, this idea that, okay, well, we've intervened, you know, on a planetary scale, all of the oceans are warming, and now we're going to have to intervene again, you know, to try to save coral reefs, it seemed like we were opening sort of a new chapter, I guess, in our relationship to the natural world, or the unnatural world, or the increasingly interconnected world. And that seemed really interesting and important to me. And that really became the start of the book.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that, because I actually loved this part of your book. We had Ruth Gates on our show a couple of years ago. Well, more than that, because sadly, Ruth Gates passed in 2018. She was director of the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology in Manoa, and she was featured in this incredible documentary called Chasing Coral. And that's how we learned about Ruth Gates. So I was, you know, pleasantly surprised, I guess is the word I'll use, when I read the first line, Ruth Gates fell in love with the ocean while watching TV. I mean, and you were lucky enough to actually meet Ruth.
Yes, I spent a week or so at the Institute, which was a is a wonderful place on a little tiny island, which will be familiar to any of your listeners who used to watch Gilligan's Island. It was like sort of the opening shot of the TV series Gilligan's Island, which I, as a Gilligan's Island fan, was really happy to hear. It's a really magical place in Kanoe Bay. And Ruth was a very dynamic and very, you know, brilliant scientist and a very dynamic person. And we became, you know, when you're interviewing someone over a period of a long time, I guess you sort of develop a kind of intimacy, which is interesting. And so we sort of became friends, and I was really admired her. She's a very, very charismatic person, and she really got me thinking. And it was, you know, I actually was getting in touch with her to try to go back and see how the project had progressed when she told me that she was really ill.
And you met with Ruth and other scientists who are trying to create a new, it's called super coral, that can tolerate rising temperatures and acidifying oceans. And they're doing it by collecting coral sperm, mixing one species with another. And one of the researchers said, we're constantly moving genes around the world, usually in the form of entire genomes. So tell us more about what you learned there.
Well, what they're trying to do in the Super Coral Project, which continues, and I was in Australia, so it was a sort of joint American-Australian project, and where the woman who started the project with Ruth, a very nice woman named Madeline Van Oppen, is still working on it. And so are Ruth's students in Hawaii. And the idea there is, well, if some, you know, coral reefs have been devastated, but obviously some have survived, some corals have survived. And what is there a genetics sort of underlying that survivorship that we could access and try to promote those genotypes that, you know, are more robust? Could we, for example, take corals from parts of the reef? And the Great Barrier Reef, for example, is a very, very large reef system, stretches over something like 1,500 miles. So parts of it are already very warm, parts near the equator. Could we sort of cross corals from the northern part of the reef with corals from the central part of the reef, see if some of their offspring are more robust than either of their parents? So these are all, you know, question marks, to be honest, right now. But we're also trying to manipulate, and this is another interesting aspect of the project. Corals have these, you know, corals are these very tiny gelatinous animals that build, you know, these huge structures. And what enables them, or one of the things that enables them to do this, is they have these plant symbionts that live inside their cells and basically feed them. So they get the food from these symbionts. And what happens when water temperatures spike and cause these coral bleaching events is that they basically expel their symbionts. So they sort of starve to death. And one question is whether you could find some symbionts are associated with better heat tolerance. No one knows exactly why. Could you identify why? Could you sort of spread those symbionts? Could you get corals to take up with new symbionts? These are all really, really interesting questions. Right now, they are still just questions, though.
You write that it's estimated that one out of every four creatures in the oceans spends at least part of its life on the reef. The Great Barrier Reef isn't a reef so much as a collection of reefs, some 3,000 in all. It stretches over 135,000 square miles, an area larger than Italy, which is just incredible. You write, if there's a more spectacular place on Earth or collection of places, I'm unaware of it. You know, I just wonder, Elizabeth, because you've been to so many incredible places, including the Great Barrier Reef, and you spoke to people about what it's going to take to try to save it, if that's even possible at this point. And given that you've had these close experiences and you've spoken with scientists, how do you think about the fact that we could lose even more, or the fact that we need to, you know, do whatever we can? Well, we needed to do it 20, 30 years ago. But as someone who's so deep in all of this, How are you thinking about these issues? That if we don't take needed action in the next 10 years, you know, we already know what could possibly happen.
Well, I you know, on one level, obviously it's simply heartbreaking. I mean, the Great Barrier Reef, you know, as anyone who's ever watched, you know, Jacques Cousteau or any of their, you know, or Chasing Coral or any of the fantastic documentaries on reefs knows, or certainly anyone who's ever visited a healthy reef, which is, you know, to be honest, harder and harder to do, knows that they're just extraordinary places beyond almost dreamlike in how rich they are with life and with vibrant colors. And just you feel as if you've, you know, fallen into some other dimension when you're on a healthy reef. And but I should point out that I myself, you know, it's really when you talk to the reef scientists who will tell you, well, this is an amazing place, but, you know, you should have been here 20, 30 years ago when I first started out. I can see all the damage that's already occurred. So there's this, you know, phenomenon where if you just arrive someplace, you know, a reasonably healthy reef is still a part of the Great Barrier Reef, is still an amazing, amazing sight. But if you've been diving the reefs for, you know, as I say, 20 or 30 years, I think what stands out to people more and more is what's missing.
Right. And you interviewed Paul Hardesty, who's the CEO of the Australian Institute of Marine Science. And he said, quote, if we can extend the life of the reef by 20, 30 years, that might be just enough for the world to get its act together on emissions. And it might make the difference between having nothing and having some sort of functional reef. He said, I mean, it's really sad that we have to talk like that, but that's where we are now.
Yes. And I think that really sums it up, doesn't it? I mean, what a lot of the people that I was, you know, spoke to in the book we're talking about was this period, which, you know, may be the next century, or it's hard to put an exact time frame on it, but, you know, possibly, and this is, you know, sort of unfortunately, I suppose you could say the best case scenario. The best case scenario is that by the end of this century, you know, the human population of the planet will level off. You know, perhaps we will have gotten our act together to bring carbon emissions way, way, way down, you know, and perhaps we will have gotten our act together in other ways, and our impacts on the planet will start to decline. But the question, so the real, really pressing question, or a really pressing question, I should say, is how can you get as many species as possible through this century, which the great, you know, E.O. Wilson has called this phenomenon the bottleneck. You know, there's this bottleneck. How do you get as many species as possible through this time? And on the Great Barrier Reef, you know, what they were concluding, or what some people were concluding, I should say, was, well, we're going to have to intervene again. You know, we're going to have to. When I was on the Great Barrier Reef, I mean, here's another telling fact, I suppose. there was a group, a team of scientists from a museum and a zoo in Australia who were collecting coral gametes, so coral eggs and sperm, to freeze. So, like, you know, in case there's a true apocalypse, you know, well, we'll have this stuff in the freezer. You know, that's sort of the point we're at.
Wow. Can you just explain to us what the experience was like to see spawning corals?
Yes, it's a marvelous experience. Now, if you're out on the actual reef, which I have been in when I wrote The Sixth Extinction, I was actually fortunate enough to be out on the reef during a spawning, which is, you know, in the water snorkeling. And what happens is that these tiny little creatures, each one of them, most corals or many coral species, they're hermaphrodites. So they produce both eggs and sperm, and they produce them in these little bundles that look like pink glass beads, basically. And they get a cue. They need to release them all at the same time. It's sort of like this weird, you know, orgy, basically. They release them tied to the temperature of the water and the cue from the moon, believe it or not, the moonlight. And so you can sort of time it and know when it's going to happen. And we went out snorkeling at night as they were releasing these little bundles. And what happens is they float up. They sort of seem to defy gravity. So it's sort of like being in a blizzard, but the snow is falling upwards. So it looks like all these little bubbles effervescing to the surface of the water. And it's quite an extraordinary sight. And also lots and lots of creatures come out to eat these bundles because, you know, there's a lot of protein there. So you see a lot of creatures, you know, chasing after them. So it's sort of an amazing nighttime. It always happens at night. So it's an amazing nighttime spectacle.
Wow. And you have a photo of it in your book, which is just really incredible. Today, we are speaking with journalist Elizabeth Colbert about her new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. And Elizabeth gives us a number of examples of humans really messing with nature. And here we are in 2021, and the experiment did not go so well. That's probably an understatement. And so now humans have to figure out how to mess with it again. And so if you have any questions for Elizabeth Colbert about what she found, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You can also tweet at Your Call Radio. Well, again, I'm so glad you brought up the Great Barrier Reef because I thought if we start with the Chicago River and then go through it, we might not get there. So I'm glad we started there instead because it's just so important. So let's go to the beginning of the book and you start with the Chicago River. I mean, this is just it's a fascinating visual. You write that more than a century ago, engineers reversed the flow of the polluted river away from Lake Michigan into the Mississippi River watershed. So explain to us what exactly happened there. In the 20th century, Chicago was pouring all of its waste into the Chicago River, which ran through the city and east into Lake Michigan. So just tell us about what happened there and why it was changed so drastically.
Sure. So Chicago, you know, grew up along this river. It's not a big river, but it's an important one. It has a couple branches. It basically, anyone who's been to Chicago, you know, knows that that the Chicago waterway really runs through the center of the city. And as Chicago grew up, the river was key because it was where Chicago dumped its waste. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. And it dumped its human waste, and it dumped, as the stockyards grew, it dumped all of the excrement and waste from the stockyards. And it was said that the Chicago River was so thick with filth that a chicken could walk across it without getting her feet wet. And the problem with this was, you know, A, it was simply, you know, gross, but B, as the Chicago River flowed east into Lake Michigan, it was actually flowing into the city's source of drinking water because Chicago got its drinking water and still gets its drinking water from Lake Michigan. So around the turn of the 20th century, it was decided something had to be done about this. There was a lot of waterborne disease, constant outbreaks of waterborne disease. And the decision was made, okay, we're not going to let the Chicago River flow into Lake Michigan anymore. We're going to reverse the flow. And to do that, they built this enormous canal. It was one of the biggest construction projects of its day. It's called the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. And it had the impact, and it connected up the river with the Mississippi system, basically. And that allowed the river, so the river no longer flows. They put a lock, you know, on the top of the river at Lake Michigan, and the river no longer flows into Lake Michigan. It basically flows away from Lake Michigan. Now, that solved one problem. It really did. You know, it took Chicago's waste out of Lake Michigan, but it opened up this connection that shouldn't be there between the Great Lakes drainage system and the Mississippi drainage system. And that is now what we're contending with.
And also, as you write, it didn't just flush waste towards St. Louis. It also upended the hydrology of roughly two-thirds of the United States, which had major ecological consequences.
Right. So those two systems, the Great Lakes Drainage Basin and the Mississippi Drainage Basin, which are both huge. The Mississippi in particular is huge, covers, you know, most of the U.S., all of the tributaries of the Mississippi and the Mississippi itself, third in size only to the Amazon and the Congo drainage basin. So really a major drainage basin. Those two, you should, if you were a fish or, you know, a crustacean, you should not be able to get from the Great Lakes into the Mississippi or vice versa. Now you can through this man-made channel. And the reason that this is a problem is not, you know, just because species can move from one to the other, you know, and that's always dubious when you connect up ecosystems and bring together creatures that have evolved separately. But what really has been a tremendous problem is that both the Great Lakes and the Mississippi have, over the course of the 20th century, become highly invaded water systems. So, you know, dozens and dozens of invasive species that are what's called established. They're you know, very well established in both basins and wreaking havoc in both basins. And people became sort of acutely aware, well, we don't want the species that are wreaking havoc in the Great Lakes to be wreaking havoc in the Mississippi and vice versa. And so what that led to was this intervention on top of an intervention, which was that they have now literally electrified a section of that canal to try to discourage animals from passing from the Great Lakes into the Mississippi.
And so they electrified a part of the water system. And when I read this, I just thought, oh, these poor fish. I mean, you know, when humans mess up nature, who gets hit the hardest in the beginning is the animals and, of course, the people. But these poor fish, so if they're trying to cross from one basin to another, they're getting volts in their body.
Yes. Now, to be you know, fair to the folks, the Army Corps of Engineers who put this system in place, one of the reasons that they chose, you know, high voltage, you know, pulsing power into the water, pulsing electricity into the water, was it was actually thought to be among the more humane ways of dealing with this problem, because if you're a fish and you start to feel a shock, you will hopefully, you know, turn around as opposed to plunging on. So, you know, you should, if all is going well, you know, not be actually electrocuting the fish, but actually just nudging them back in the opposite direction.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we are speaking with Elizabeth Colbert about her new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Elizabeth is the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe and The Sixth Extinction, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize. For her work at The New Yorker, where she's a staff writer, she's received 2 national magazine awards. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we're joined by New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert. She's out with another important new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. And she writes about how humans have tried to control nature for generations only to create even more damage. And so how can we actually save nature for the future? And given the track record of humans, should we? That is another important question. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have a question from a listener who says, how did this reversal impact Lake Michigan?
Well, I don't think it had a tremendous... I mean, you would have, I think the water level did drop somewhat on Lake Michigan, and there are all sorts of complicated, you know, treaties, as it were, or agreements about, you know, how much water can be allowed to flow out of Lake Michigan, because now, as I say, you have locks on it to prevent it from sort of all, you know, pouring down into the Mississippi. But I don't think anyone would say that the digging of the canal had that much impact on Lake Michigan, except to connect it and therefore all the Great Lakes to the as I say, to the Mississippi system. I mean, in a lot of ways, you would say it was actually quite helpful for Lake Michigan, because otherwise it would still be, you know, taking all of Chicago's waste, which, you know, was obviously not good for the system.
Mm. Well, let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm afraid that, and I'm hoping to get your book and read it, but I'm afraid that there's just an incredible amount of denial still going on amongst too many people in this country and around the world about just where we're headed. 350 parts, I don't know if it's parts per billion, of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was sort of the benchmark. We've gone way beyond 400. And I hate to use the jargon, but I think scientists use this term, baked in, when they talk about the fact that what we've already done is still going to have significant impacts heading into the future. The problem that I'm seeing is that the Sunshine Movement, the Sierra Club, all these Extinction Rebellion were supposed to save us, if you will. And I'm living in a community which just finished a six-story, 700-space parking garage. That's Palo Alto, which has a population of 60,000 people. The people on the city council here are like flat earthers. So I don't know how you get to these people to convince them, hey, if we don't do something right now, we're going to be in really bad shape, and we're not going to believe what's going to happen in the next 5, 10, or 15 years. Mm. So that's, I just don't know how you get this turned around. That's the problem.
Well, thank you, Greg. Elizabeth, what are your thoughts on that? We talk about this every Monday, at least, on this show.
Well, I think that's very much, honestly, at the center of my book, Under White Sky, and that is this point that we are in this very deep. You know, we have radically, very dramatically, yes, radically, I think that's not a fair word, transformed the planet, not just, you know, as you read that excerpt, we transformed the surface of the planet. We've cut down a lot of the forests. We've changed the carbon cycle. We've changed the nitrogen cycle. We've talked about how we've changed the oceans. We're changing the climate very fast. So this is not, you know, like a small perturbation of the system. This is really serious stuff. And even if we were to stop now, as your caller suggested, the system has a lot of inertia in it. So, you know, even if we were to reach zero emissions, let's say, tomorrow, which, you know, obviously evidently isn't happening, at that point, what we would have done is, you know, stopped making the problem worse, but the problem wouldn't have gone away. You know, the ice sheets would continue to melt, sea levels would continue to rise. So these problems are not, it's very hard to turn this battleship around. And that is precisely why I think in coming years, that in combination with the fact that we are not even trying to turn it around, to be honest, you know, we are, as your caller suggested, still putting up a lot of infrastructure that's tied to a fossil fuel based economy. That is going to lead, I think, in coming decades, I'm not sure about the timescale here, but to more and more talk of very radical interventions, because, you know, if you're, car is sort of unstoppable, you know, you have to, it's a little bit like the, you know, the Roadrunner cartoons, you know, how the crazy schemes to stop something that's been put in motion.
Hmm. Of all the solutions that you've written about in your books, you know, all the conversations that you've had with people who are really dedicating their lives to try to create change on these issues, can you tell us which ones you think are most promising and least damaging? I mean, what really stands out for you?
Well, what the book, you know, the sort of structure of the book, I guess, is it starts with projects that already exist. So, you know, I took a, you know, wonderful boat trip with a group called the Friends of the Chicago River down this canal that was built to, you know, flush Chicago's waste away. And it was really quite a fun trip, even though it's not a very scenic waterway, I have to say, until we got to these electric barriers where there are these huge signs that say, you know, don't go in the water because you will basically electrocute yourself. So that's a project that already exists, and it the book sort of follows other projects that already exist or are very much in the design phase, engineering phase. And then towards the end of the book, we get to sort of, you know, we go through this the Supercoral project, which, you know, people, how do people feel about that? How do we feel about, you know, sort of manipulating other creatures like that to see if we can come up with, you know, better versions of them? Well, maybe we feel okay about that. But then we get, you know, to gene editing, which is very much the next step, right? If you could identify a gene in coral that is associated with better heat tolerance, should you try to gene edit corals? You know, so it's sort of a slippery slope that we are on. And how you feel about these interventions, you know, whether you feel this intervention is good, you might think to yourself as you read the book, you know, which I certainly hope people will, but you might think, well, okay, that's okay. You know, that's okay. And then that's okay. And then by the end, I think your feeling is, oh my God, wow. You know, is this really the world that we want to live in?
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you for the question, Greg. We will continue to bring that up on these shows. let's go next to Peter in Tampa, Florida. Hi, Peter. Thanks for holding.
Hi. First time calling the show.
Well, great. It's great to hear from you in Florida. I hope you're all staying safe there.
Yeah. In fact, I just moved here recently, but I got in touch with the local the Sierra Club person here, and I spoke with her, and she told me that she was instrumental. She helped set up the coral reef around the Florida Keys as a protected marine sanctuary. And I learned the first largest coral reef in the world, of course, is the Great Barrier Reef. The second largest is off of Belize, I believe. But the third largest is right here around the Florida Keys. And what new activities are taking place there? I did hear something in the news a few weeks ago. They're trying to introduce or fix something. Do you know about anything on the horizon? What's happening with the Florida coral reef?
Well, I don't want to pretend to be an expert on, you know, sort of on the ground efforts to protect or restore Florida reefs, but I will say that I do know a lot of people are working very hard. Florida's reefs have been really hard hit by a number of factors, you know, development, runoff. There's a disease that has killed off a lot of the corals in, you know, the sort of Atlantic basin, I guess you would say, the Caribbean. So people are definitely trying to, sort of minimize the damage going forward, and then also restore parts of the reef that have been really heavily impacted. And I definitely urge everyone listening in Florida, you know, to get involved in those efforts. And certainly if you're living on the Keys, because it's you know, obviously would be a tragedy to lose, you know, what remains of Florida's reefs.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in, Peter. We will definitely do a show about Florida's reefs. And since you are in Florida, I hope you can listen to, if you didn't catch it, a show we did about Florida panthers a few weeks ago. Elizabeth, this is a really interesting topic. Florida panthers are really in trouble because of a proposed development funded by big money and special interest, a lot of new homes, like hundreds of thousands of cars, if I remember correctly, about 200,000. And it really does raise a question about, well, you know, what it will take to rethink our whole idea around development in this country, because we hear grow, 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 especially in a place like the Bay Area. We need to build more. We need to build more. Has this come up with some of the interviews that you've done in your work?
Well, I mean, certainly just, you know, what we call sprawl. And the last time I was in Florida, I remember very vividly just seeing this large tract of land that had obviously been covered in vegetation, which obviously some creatures had lived in, had just been scraped down to the bedrock, which in Florida is this ancient coral reef. I mean, it's all built on old limestone, which raises a lot of problems for the state as we move forward because of sea level rise, because it's very hard to keep the water out of this, of that kind of rock, because it has some, it's just basically so porous. So the water, you know, you could, the water just comes in from the sides. But that's a little bit of a different issue. And yes, obviously the financial stakes of development are so high that it's very, very difficult to, you know, prevent development. And I, you know, certainly on some level applaud people who are trying. Now, you could argue, though, in the Bay Area, you maybe have a little bit of a different problem, which is that, you know, housing prices are so high, and people, I think, would argue, well, we need to do more sort of vertical development, right? We need to have more people occupy that part of the state or the city that's already very highly developed. And, you know, that raises a lot of neighborhood concerns, because people don't, you know, want their neighborhoods to change. So, you know, you could argue that's encouraging more sprawl, right? If we're not going to build in downtown San Francisco, then people are going to move an hour away, 2 hours away, and drive to work. So these are not, you know, easy, easy issues to solve. And I don't want to pretend that I have easy answers to them.
Well, thanks again for calling, Peter. Nice to hear from you. Today, we are joined by New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert, who's out with a new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. We've got just about 10 minutes left, Elizabeth. And of course, we'd love to talk about Louisiana, because this was another really fascinating part of your book. You write that since the 1930s, Louisiana has shrunk by more than 2,000 square miles. If Delaware or Rhode Island had lost that much territory, the U.S. would have only 49 states. And this is incredible. Every hour and a half, Louisiana sheds another football field's worth of land. Every few minutes, it drops a tennis court's worth.
So Louisiana, southern Louisiana, is a delta. You know, it's built on a river delta. It's all land. All of that land was created by the Mississippi itself as it flowed through the Great Plains, and also the Missouri, you know, which is known as the Big Muddy, carries a lot of sediment into the Mississippi. The Mississippi gets down to the Gulf of Mexico. It slows down as it hits the Gulf. And every spring before, you know, the French arrived in the area, the Mississippi overflowed its banks, and it dropped a lot of the sediment across the landscape. And that's what created land. It was just layers and layers of sediment built up over years and years and years. And when the Mississippi built a new bulge of land, which is technically known as a delta lobe, the gradient would get too steep. So it was sort of getting in its own way, and it would flip course, and it would take a whole new course, and it would lay down another lobe of land. And that's all that southern Louisiana is, just these ancient delta lobes, you know, built sort of one next to and sometimes on top of the other. And then, you know, the French came along in 1718, established New Orleans, and suddenly got the idea, well, the river is going to have to stay put. It's going to have to stay in its banks. And that began this 300-year effort to keep the Mississippi in its banks. And with, you know, very notable failures, it has, for the most part, been successful. But the flip side of that, you know, the once again unintended consequence of that is that you no longer get any land building. And this very marshy, wet, deltaic soil compacts over time and sinks. And so if you're not getting any fresh sediment into it, you're getting this phenomenon known as subsidence, which is just basically your land is sinking. And if you add on top of that sea level rise, which is accelerating now, you get, you know, more and more land being lost basically to the Gulf of Mexico.
And it's important to point out, and you write about this in your book, you write that Native Americans were living in the Delta even as it was being created. Their strategy for dealing with the river's vagaries, as far as archaeologists have been able to determine, was one of accommodation. When the Mississippi flooded, they sought higher ground, and when it shifted quarters, they did too. And just reading that kind of sparked my interest, and so I did a little research on Native tribes in Louisiana. And there were clearly a lot of people there, because the federal government now recognizes 4 tribes and the state recognizes 10 additional tribes. So a lot of people were in this area just really working with nature. When things moved, they moved.
Yes, exactly. I mean, one thing I do want to say is, you know, not all tribes were in the
right,
you know, southern part of that. But yes, right, absolutely. Archaeological finds, you know, a lot of them have probably been flooded out, to be honest. But, you know, we know that there were people living in southern Louisiana. It's a very rich, you know, that kind of marshland is, you know, great hunting grounds. And definitely seasonally, at least, people were there, have been there for thousands of years. And, you know, we can only infer how they lived from the archaeological remains. But all of our ancestors, you know, wherever they were, they, you know, they were hunter-gatherers. They moved with the weather. They moved with migrating animals. You know, that's how they lived. And when we set down permanent settlements, you know, which in southern Louisiana, as I said, was not until 1718, it changed our relationship to our surroundings in a very profound way, that we're now, you know, seeing some of the – it allowed us to – grow phenomenally, right? I mean, New Orleans is a big city, but it also had very serious repercussions.
Right. And New Orleans, I mean, gets attention, rightly so, for its incredible culture. You can find stories about this, but obviously it doesn't get that much attention. And as you write, New Orleans is sinking very, very fast. Without getting more sediment onto the landscape, it'll disappear. And the plan is to create controlled flooding. Can you talk more about that?
Yes, sure. So this is this, you know, once again, this, you know, intervention. The intervention was to prevent the Mississippi from flooding. Now we're seeing that if you just completely starve the landscape of the sediment, you can't preserve the countryside. So now the proposal is we're going to basically try to recreate, you know, what nature did, which was to flood the landscape. We can't simply let the Mississippi flood, you know, New Orleans. That's not practical at this point. But what we're going to try to do is sort of punch these holes in the levees south of New Orleans. And when the river is at very high, probably in the spring, carrying a lot of sediment, we will let it run through these channels, these sort of channelized openings in the levees, and it will run out into these bays, either, you know, Barataria Bay, and create new land. And hopefully, it is hoped, that that will be sort of a buffer that will protect New Orleans from, you know, hurricanes, among other things.
Well, we have time for one last caller, Rich from Boulder Creek. And if you can be quick, Rich, we're almost out of time.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, it seems to me that most of the land that's worth living in has been taken up already. I'm talking about the East and West Coasts, the Gulf, the Mississippi, and the Great Lakes. And as such, people tend to live there. And there's only so much arable land, and I think that the thing is there's just too many people for the land to support. And I think we should look at immigration look at it as the ecosystem is just being overloaded, and people should just think about having less kids. That would be my input now that I'm a senior citizen, you see.
Well, thank you. You briefly write about this in your book, Elizabeth, about how like the U.S. compares to Europe, comparing to other countries. And I mean, it's just the U.S. On many, many levels uses more, emits more down the line. What are your thoughts on this? Is it really a question of population or is it a question of human decisions?
Well, it's, you know, if you look at our sort of total impact of humanity on the world. It's a function of, you know, how many there are and how many of us there are and how many and what kind of consumption patterns we have, right? How much resources we're using. And, you know, both of those are significant. And we here in the U.S. are very, very, very high consumers. Our birth rates are, you know, relatively low. And then there are parts of the world where birth rates are still pretty high, where people are very, very low consumers. And we kind of need, you know, if we want to make this, you know, the century of maximum or the decades of maximum human impacts, we need to try to bring both of those down. We need to bring, you know, birth rates down in parts of the world where they're still high. And we also need very seriously to bring consumption down in parts of the world where consumption is very high. And I don't really think there's any way of getting around that math.
Mm. Well, thank you for the call, Rich. Final thoughts, Elizabeth. What would you say is one of the main takeaways from your book after all the traveling that you've done and the interviews that you did?
Well, one thing I'd like to say about the book, which
and
I
we have
know...
We have about a minute left.
Okay. Which I know sounds odd after the very heavy-duty subjects that we've talked about. But one thing I'd like to say is that the book is supposed to be kind of fun, sort of a dark comedy. So it's not all just doom and gloom. How's that? That's, I guess, one thought I'd like to leave people with.
Yeah, and you learn so much. I mean, it's like we take trips with you to these places. So
thank you for
bringing us with you. And thank you for doing the all of the research, because obviously so much went into this.
Well, thanks for coming along for the ride, and thanks for having me on.
All right. Well, thank you again, Elizabeth. And I hope you can check out Elizabeth Colbert's new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Elizabeth is also author of The Sixth Extinction, and she is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.